Hello everyone, this is Brad Rao, bradraomusic.com, and today I have a pretty interesting lecture. Tradition, Descartes, and General Semantics is going to be the title of this. We're going to go through a little philosophical musical journey, or I'm going to attempt to take you through one. It's going to make sense how these kind of view together, and it started with a Facebook post that I posted, a kind of a long one. I think that I might as well make a podcast where I can express my ideas, develop them a little bit further than just a blanket bum. So here we go. So tradition, in my opinion, is the opposite of creativity and innovation. Tradition, in my opinion, is the opposite of creativity and innovation and evolution and newness, the creation of literally something new and not the replication of something that previously existed. And as a classical musician, I make a stand that I'm trying to not necessarily reject all the tradition, but really evaluate the tradition in a new way, because what I see a lot in classical music, and I'm not saying everybody is guilty of this, and I'm not saying that everybody does this to the 100% degree, but I think that anyone who went to classical music school, would have to agree that there's a tendency to just say that there's a superiority in knowing the one single correct way to interpret the piece that was passed down, and a kind of a looking down on someone who is not playing a piece at the right tempo or blah blah blah, not doing a trill on the right note, making sure that we are doing, if there's a sort of a swingish thing or if there isn't, if it should be played with a metronome or if it should be a free, liberated piece. What I have found, these questions, first of all, only really arise in classical music because we're using a notated score to come up with this. So first of all, these issues don't really exist with, Jimi Hendrix or Miles Davis, because we can hear them play, and we know their subtleties, and we can take what we want from them, and we can and the idea is not necessarily to replicate them directly, but to hear the nuances and the subtleties which are left in the recording. And if you've ever tried to play a jazz solo transcribed for sheet music, which is certainly helpful, you will very quickly realize that the subtleties of this solo, or the reason that you probably decided to learn the solo in the first place, actually aren't really included in the music. But the music is just like the notes and a basic rhythm. But there's another, the feeling of it, which I mean not necessarily emotional, but rhythmic feel, just little kind of nuances, hitting extra strings, or sort of these little, even imperfections, you might call them, that happen in recordings. So these nuances are left out of the music. So when we're trying to play someone like Bach, when we're trying to play someone like Beethoven, when we're trying to play Giuliani or Sor or Targa, we're left with this issue of we're not sure how fast it's supposed to go, we're not sure how the tempo is supposed to be, if it's rigid or if there's a swing or if there's a sway or if there's a rubato or if there's no rubato. There seems to be we do have answers now, and there's kind of an established classical tradition on how these answers are supposed to be formed. And I guess that's good, because once we know these things, you're settled. And when you know the answer to these questions and you have them, then you're good to go. The problem with this is that if you've studied with more than one teacher, or if you've read different books, or at least books influenced by different people, you're not going to get a lot of difference between Canon Geyser's DVDs and the Pumping Nylon DVDs, because they're both from the Romero school, and they hardly disagree on anything. I think maybe like two or three very small, really insignificant personal disagreements. I wouldn't even say that they would disagree, but just comparing the two works side by side, I'm pretty familiar with both. But when you look at the way that other people play, studying with Elliot, a lot of the things that I used to do that I stopped doing because of this Romero school pumping nylon Canon Geyser, I ended up finding that I'm doing again. So if you evaluate these sources enough, you actually find that there's more to the story than what meets the eye. And that it almost seems like we should start by doubting the entire tradition. And this is why the word Descartes is incorporated into this title, is because Descartes was famous for his little thing, I think, therefore I am. And that came from a doctrine where basically he started by doubting everything. In a more philosophical sense, he doubted the existence. Like, how do I know? I don't know the universe exists. I don't know anything exists. Everything could be an illusion, blah, 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 blah. Going down to just doubting everything. And the one thing that he was not able to doubt is that because he thought, he knew that he had to exist. So that was the revelation, I think, therefore I am. That was the one certainty that he knew, even just deriving truth from pure rational thought and doubting everything. He was able to conclude that he exists because he thinks. And how could he think if he doesn't exist? So that was his idea. You know, I've made the joke, I don't think, therefore I am not. So what happens if you don't think? Nietzsche has the same more whimsical and with more exclamation points. I don't remember the exact quote, but Nietzsche also pushes that aside at basically saying that if you don't think, well, anyway, I'm not here to deny Descartes, but of course in philosophy there's other philosophers who disagree with Descartes, that's what philosophy is all about. So I just wanted to throw that in. But let's come into Descartes. I think we should enter Descartes' world, and we should begin by doubting everything. And his whole, I think, therefore I am. Now, once Descartes was able to realize that he exists, he also is able to deduce that, you know, if he exists, well, he would have to live. How could he exist if he wasn't able to eat food? So the food would have to exist. And then how could the food couldn't exist unless there was a planet? And then that planet couldn't exist without the sun. And you would need a universe, and you would need, you know, he wouldn't be able to exist if, you know, and if you think about this today, although not relevant for Descartes, like, I wouldn't be able to exist like this if it wasn't for a car. If there's actually a lot of things that would, you know, have to exist in order for me to be able to exist, in order for my thinking to be able to exist, which I know is true. And he is able to rationally deduce the entire universe, up including God. He ends up tying God into this too, where he concludes at the end that all of this stuff, if you continue down the rabbit hole one more step, that this actually means, of course, that if the universe exists, then some kind of idea would have to have created it, and that's where he ties the God into this too. So from pure he goes from complete pure skepticism to ending up deducing through pure rational thought, without even using the senses, that the world would exist and God would exist. So that's Descartes' whole kind of thing. And I think that the classical tradition could use a little bit of this Descartes-type stripping down of everything. And so not necessarily to just purely reject all the tradition, But to really look at some of these traditions, because I think there's a lot of things that if when you investigate it further, you find out that these things that we're certain of in terms of interpreting music actually turn out not to be as true as they thought, as we think, or maybe relatively true, or, you know, not to say that something is completely true or completely false, but, you know, most of the time, this might happen instead of everybody, you know, between the period when the date that the broke period began to the date the broke period ended, everybody did a trill on the top note, and on that exact day that Bach died, people started trilling on the bottom note, kind of thing, which is relatively true, but in real, you know, if you think about this time, does everybody do a particular thing in a particular way all the time? Maybe there are certain trends where, yes, everybody's writing 4/4 in pop music, but there are examples of non-4/4 music, plenty of them in, you know, less common, but still happens in pop music every now and then. And I think that's, which can be the interesting thing. Of course, usually a pop song has that one particular interesting thing. So coming back to the idea of beginning by doubting the entire tradition and then seeing if we can deduce some of these things purely on our own through pure skepticism. So that's what this lecture is going to be about. I'm not necessarily saying this is the only way or this is even the way that I do it, because it actually isn't, but I'm going to kind of pull us all the way to the side and say, see what we can figure out about a piece of music through sort of this Sherlock Holmes deduction of just looking at the piece of music itself and seeing if from that we could figure out how the piece should be played, and looking at the different evidence, not necessarily through a historical manner, but through the piece itself and having the piece be a fingerprint of what it should be. So by starting by doubting everything, the first thing we would have to look at are ways that we're going to figure out the piece. So one question is like what the tempo is. Now I believe, and I tell this to my students, that a piece of music will tell you the tempo itself if you listen. If you play a piece of music at different tempos, you will find that there's one tempo where the piece of music will sound the best, or at least a tempo range. If you take a slow piece, Moonlight Sonata, for example, and if you play it too fast, it doesn't sound good. You have to, if you play the piece at different tempos, you'll find, and of course if you play it too slow, it also won't sound good too. So if you try playing it at different tempos, you'll find that there'll be about, and it's usually the tempo most people play it at. Maybe this is just a bias because I already know the answer and I try to pretend I don't. But I think there's more to it than that, because I've also done this where teaching students pieces where I'm not even sure what the tempo is, you know, some Renaissance pieces or things like that, or just pieces, studies from Frederick Knode's books where there's not really a tempo listed, and I don't know I've never heard Frederick Knode play it, and because it's a beginner book, it's probably meant to be played at really whatever speed you can. But still, I think that if you play the piece at different tempos, you find that there is a single tempo that the piece itself will sound most beautiful. And maybe you're capable of playing faster, and some people will make the mistake, of playing faster simply because they can, the enjoyment of developing speed. But I think that that's something that can actually be found on its own. Now, in terms of playing with a metronome, I think that that's an interesting kind of thing. The metronome was Beethoven actually hired a guy, or not necessarily hired, but kind of, convinced a guy to create a metronome. He was sort of the inspiration for why the metronome was created. So on the one hand, that means that nobody before Beethoven played with a metronome. So if you're playing that music with them, playing that music with a metronome in that respect means that isn't historically accurate. But then people will argue that, well, it's dance music and dance music needs to be predictable rhythm, or at least, meeting the ideal of the metronome, so that you should play it with the metronome. So then that point is wrong. But then if you look at it again, a lot of dance music actually had fluctuations in tempo. The waltz, for example, isn't a steady beat, but has a fluctuation at the end. And sometimes the dance itself will have a certain swing or feel or movement to it. A lot of Baroque musicians, that is, whether to say they're Baroque or Baroque, probably both, will take classes where they'll actually learn how to do the courant. Everybody do the courant. Everybody do the sarabande. Everybody do the gavotte and the gigue. So I think that there's some value to that too, but kind of really getting an idea of the feel of that to kind of get that authentic kind of feel. Now, the undercurrent that probably a lot of people don't realize is the assumption that we're supposed to play it the way that that they did back then. And the question is, are we supposed to? Do we even need to? Because I think that what if you didn't? Glenn Gould is known to just not do things because he thinks they sound better. And I think that and a lot of people don't like Glenn Gould because he doesn't do it the traditional way. My one teacher pointed out that sometimes he'll almost deliberately do the opposite, something that would be in poor taste, almost to just kind of just stand out and be different. He knows what the right thing to do is, and he would do something differently. The product of your environment in reversal, which is still in some way, a reaction against the trend, which I guess this is too. The other thing that I find is that the study of the piece of music itself will actually tell you a lot about how to interpret that, what notes to play loud, what notes to not play loud, whether or not certain things maybe should be slowed down. Because if you really understand what's going on in a piece of music, it's a lot easier to be expressive. I think that a lot of people try to dress up a skeleton enough so that it seems like a real person. Eliot would talk about Pinocchio, where you have a piece of wood and you're trying to dress it up and make it look like it's alive. And how do you make something become alive? How do you make a piece of wood become alive is an interesting thought. Now, one of the ways that you could try to make something seem like it's alive is to look at the properties of life. Usually things that are alive breathe, so you can try to make the music breathe. If you look at other people, maybe living people, when they talk, they have a fluctuation that goes down at the end of the sentence. So then you start saying, I'll fluctuate down on all of my musical sentences. And then you start doing, but without even really considering the line itself and just pasting this interpretational idea into the song, without really considering the song itself, I think that the study of the song, understanding the way that the music was constructed, and then making an interpretation decision based off of that as the end result of, is a much more effective way than trying to pigeonhole the song into something out of a guess, where you could try to say that a piece is supposed to be played with a certain emotion. I remember I was working on the chaconne, and I was thinking about what emotion is the chaconne overall. I know there's a major section, but just like the blanket emotion, what would be the single motion, or even just, and then I reduced that to even just the first phrase, the first four measures of the chaconne. What is that emotion? I ended up sort of looking into acting a little bit. I'm not trying to become an actor, but as a musician who performs and is creating emotions through music, I am becoming an actor. So I guess I am an actor. So I wanted to know how different actors would produce emotion. And I realized, and I watched a particular acting video, which I should probably link to in at the end of this. The guy talks about, you know, the other actor was saying, he's like, oh, well, you weren't listening to me when I was reading my part. And the guy said, okay, you know, and he says he wasn't listening. And then, like, they ended up going off in this thing, and he did the scene again, and then he wasn't listening. And then he did the scene again, and he wasn't listening. And then eventually the guy said, I was listening. He says, no, you weren't. That's not listening. What you're doing, you call it listening. It's not listening. So finally the actor said, well, then what is listening? And the actor said, the other actor responded, that right there. When you said, what is listening? That was listening. When you say, what is it? When you're taking it in, he's like, you took me in. The actor said that he realized that he would have to know his lines really well. Like, his lines would have to be his DNA in order for him to be like, well, what is happening there? You know, he talks about, like, if you have to look for something on stage, actually look for it. You know, see if you can find it. Maybe one time you might. So if you, when interpreting a piece of music, I realized that instead of trying to say, okay, I think that the chaconne is sad, so I'm going to try to make it sound sad, and then I, try to project sadness through the music myself, and hopefully, you know, subconsciously through the notes. But instead, if I say, what is the chaconne? If that's my mantra, is like, I'm hearing it as if I don't even know what's going to happen. And when the note happens, I'm even surprised by it. And that's, so then the piece of music can truly be whatever emotion it would be without you having a bias or interfering or just not playing emotionally at all. So it's not that you're necessarily ignoring emotion, but more that you are embracing. Anyway, so that's kind of a little bit of a side thought towards the music. And the other thing that, of course, you can do is you can look at historical documents. And I recommend, with doing that, I think that one of the things that I think is happening in classical music, and part of the reason I wanted to make this lecture, is people, instead of looking at historical documents, are someone like me, maybe I'll check out some historical documents, and I'll come up with a conclusion, and I'll publish a book. So this book is published in 2017 now, wow. So we have this book that was published, and what happens then is people will read this book and then think that my conclusion was correct based, you know, because I, and then quoting the historical document. So instead of looking at the information themselves, finding out what Bach said about his music, finding out what Bach's son said about his music, finding out what Beethoven says, people are finding out, and then you're getting this second-hand, and sometimes third-hand and fourth-hand information on how to play music. And if you've ever done Whisper Down the Lane, things get very easily twisted. There was a story that I heard one time, and I can't even remember what the source of it was, but it was basically talking about baking. The guy was baking brownies, and he used his mom's recipe. And when he was baking the brownies, he folded the tinfoil on the sides in a particular way. And his wife said, Why do you fold the tinfoil like that? And he says, I don't know. That's how my mom does it, so I've always done it that way. So they say, well, that's funny, you know. So he called his mom up, and he says, Mom, why do you fold the tinfoil on the brownies when you make them? Why do you fold the tinfoil to the sides like that? You don't really, like, because you, maybe, you, it sounds like maybe you don't really need to. And she was like, I don't know, that's how I've always done it. You know, I learned it from Grandmom, blah, blah, blah. So then he called up Grandmom, and he said, Grandmom, why do you, fold the tinfoil on the sides in that certain way? And she says, oh, well, I have to do that to put it in the oven. And this is kind of what happens with the tradition of, and I think this is happening in classical music, where people are you know, having this whisper down the lane where, you know, somebody, Bach says something, and then someone tells you what Bach says, and then someone reads that and then says that that's something else, and then they, you know, and then this happens again, and eventually we're so far away from the original idea, or not to say too far away from it, but usually what ends up happening is a sweeping generalization. We make these gigantic generalizations, where we say everybody does this, and we have this, you know, one of the big ones is like everybody during this period does this thing this way. And then that day that the Romantic period ended, nobody did that anymore. And you know, and if you actually think about that, it doesn't really make sense. But we are looking for some way to do that, and we have these teachers, you know, trying to do their best. And the more this information gets spread out, the more that I think that, you know, so I think that if you are going to make a decision on music, I think that you should really look at the historical documents themselves and draw your own conclusions. One of my conclusions from a couple grad school classes and looking into the historical documents, I realized that everybody does everything differently, and there's really no way, there's no certainty of saying that anything happens. And inside even a Baroque, classical, romantic, modern trend, there are many, many sub-trends, and sub-trends within that trends, and different locations where different people are doing different things. And there's really no way for you to say certainly that anyone is doing any particular thing at any particular time. So that even if you are trying to create something historically accurate, it becomes very difficult, because there's really no way of knowing what exactly historically accurate is, because every single person in history did something differently. I've heard there's as many styles as jazz as there are jazz musicians, or maybe there used to be. It sounds like now people are, you know, it sounds like jazz is about to go through the same thing that classical happened. Now I can buy a jazz theory book, and I can read the jazz theory book, and I can say, oh, now I understand how Charlie Parker and John Coltrane are making their solos. But those guys didn't read a jazz theory book. They played what they played, and now the theory is coming afterwards. If you remember being in high school, I noticed that cool kids did whatever they want, and uncool kids saw what the cool kids did and copied them. And that's the real reason that traditions go out of style in the first place. Once the posers are doing it, you know, then the cool kids, you know, have to do something else, because they have to be separated. They have to be cool. They have to be separated from the posers. They have to be one step ahead of everyone else. And once, you know, my mom, who is now a grandmom, says, like, once I start wearing something, then the girls have to take it off. So her style is behind the younger girls, who are, I guess, are defining the style, mainly because I guess you buy what you like, and every generation wears different clothing, and, you know, that's the progression of clothing, that's the progression of music, that's the progression of art. And that's what I mean when I say the tradition is the negation, the adverse function of the creativity, where it's a halt in the progress of human music. And I think that it's not a necessary halt. Even though you're playing classical music, even though you're playing Bach, you don't have to play it on an old lute with strings from an animal that you slaughtered in a farm where you slept, where there was no electricity. Like, how far does it need to go? I think that, you know, and, you know, I was also at a lecture at the GFA. I wish that I remembered the guy's name. It was a great lecture, and he was saying that literalism is the most modern approach to music. The whole idea that I'm going to try to play music in the way that they did in the period is actually a very, very new idea that no one really at any other point in time was really concerned with. And they were just playing music and they wanted it to sound good. And they would do things that they thought sounded good, and they do things that other people didn't, you know, and that they didn't think were good. And the fans who liked what they did would come, and the fans who didn't did. And the people who did what, you know, got popular did what more people liked, or, you know, however it worked. And that's the way that it goes today, and that's the way that it always goes. But I think that the idea of just these fixed interpretational decisions, I think, should really be reevaluated, you know, probably more on a personal level. I don't want to really say too many decisions that I've made, because sometimes I think they're historical, and sometimes I know that I'm not doing something historical, and I just don't really care because I think that it's a better decision musically, and I think it sounds better. It's not to say that I wouldn't be able to do that. So, you know, coming back to the idea that all of this stuff is just becoming more and more generalizations, and people are eventually taking one idea, in one piece you should do this, and then, well, I guess we should do it for every piece, and then we should do it from every piece in that time period. And that's why I wanted to end it with general semantics. The best source for hearing about general semantics is Robert Anton Wilson's Language and Reality lecture, which I will probably also have to post a link to if this becomes a video. And this is, there's other, other sources of general semantics that are probably more detailed. You can, of course, read his, get his, the hold of his book, Science and Sanity. There's a, reduced version of it that is still impossible to read, but is, and then there's a much longer version, which I haven't even tried to read. But Robert Anton Wilson, I think, does a really good job of explaining it. And he also gives you some tools, which I want to talk about, for really getting over these generalizations by just kind of realizing certain things. So the one thing is talking about certainty on a scale from 1 to 10, because a lot of Robert Anton Wilson does incorporate some uncertainty into his ideas, but he also says that his critics assume that it's complete uncertainty, and he says that that's not true at all. The sun going around, the sun coming up the following day, he puts that at a 9.9, which sounds pretty likely, but he's not completely sure, because I guess how could you be? So that's the idea of thinking about, so when you're making a statement, you know, you have to, you know, thinking about not in terms of if you're absolutely sure, but if it's a guess or if it's an educated guess, if it's a hunch, is it something that Bach said, all of my music should be played like this? I haven't yet to find a quote where Bach says, all of my music should be played like this, from him or his sons. They definitely say some things about playing music. And maybe actually what I'm thinking about that again, I'm realizing that it's not true, but it's, usually the things that they say are, a little bit more general, than just a certain mechanical kind of approach. So another tool for general semantics, which can easily be become ridiculous, and anyone who gets into this will have every ridiculous phase that may continue indefinitely, and that is replacing the word is with the word seems. And that is to say that this is historically accurate, which you would say that this seems historically accurate. It seems like that to me. You could also do what is called time binding, where you acknowledge that at this moment of time, it seems to me that this is the most historical accurate way. And that implies that there could be more data and that you don't have all the data and that you're collecting more data. And as you collect more data, your model of what historically accurate would be would increase over time, and you would have a better and better and more detailed picture. And I think that that's a little bit of a better approach, because people make these blanket generalizations as if they're complete facts and if they're completely certain. And I think that just by putting your own, you know, your own thoughts in this about music, you know, Bach seems to me to be the best composer at the time, at this time, is a much different statement than Bach is the best composer. Now, some critics will say, of course, I think we all know that we meant that. And it can get very, you can also get very far where, you know, this seems like a guitar. It seems like I'm playing guitar. It seems like I'm playing what seems to be a guitar, which seems to be strings, you know. And I think that it can become very, very, you know, it can be ridiculous. Robert Anton Wilson calls himself an agnostic mystic. And I think that even through this, if you go through this, everything seems like it instead of, you know, this is what it looks like to you instead of this is the truth, you sort of will have this mystical breaking down, which is similar to Zen Buddhism. And I don't know if that's necessarily necessary unless that's what you're going for. But I think that using it a little bit, and I think definitely talking about music, can help a little bit. You know, I wouldn't necessarily say, like, this seems like a C chord. I think it's enough to say that's a C chord. Of course, that's our language. You know, aliens wouldn't call it a C chord. They might have a different name or a different way of classifying chords. I'd be interested to find out about that. But I think it's okay to say that this is a C chord. Now, if I say a C chord is happy, most people would agree that a C chord is happy. So eventually, you know, but then there are, you know, things where, like, if I say it seems happy, I'm acknowledging that a C chord can actually be happy, can be sad. And I've actually heard a number of people refer to music as being sad. I was very surprised, and I realized that they were listening to the lyrics, and the C chord actually was sort of an irony of the, you know, of the lyrics themselves, where the C chord actually did become sad. The key C chord seemed sad. So I think there's a little bit, you know, now you, I think that getting into intervals, you know, this is a sort of an ear training where, like, if you heard a tritone, but it was a minor seventh, it was a tritone for you. I don't know. I would reject that because I think that in certain cases there are, you know, a fixed definition. So I think we have to be careful about, you know, and this goes back to how certain we are, you know, like in the framework of music theory, we're certain of certain things and we call them, you know, we would label them as those things. But in other cases, when we talk about historical documents or when we talk about information that we hear from teachers, you know, we want to make sure that we're incorporating, acknowledging that this is our interpretation. Another really good way to do that is actually to cite the source. If you know where the information came from, if you can just recall where you found out that information and cite that, that's actually something that a lot of academics do. That's something that I think they train you when you do, like, academic writing or journalism, is just citing where you heard that from, and so that you're not just stating a fact, but that you're saying, I heard from this guy that this is true. And then you can judge for yourself whether or not, you know, be like, oh, well, if that guy said it, well, I better listen. Or be like, oh, that guy said it, yeah, I don't need to listen to him. You know, or depending on what they're talking about, you know, one person might be very knowledgeable in one area of music and not very knowledgeable in another area of music, or maybe they're knowledgeable in music but not in another field. So that's a way, instead of just having these fixed ideas where this is how you play it, we have the ideas of where they come from. And I'm always interested and when I hear an idea is to find someone else who has an opposing idea, to see if that idea holds up, or like if I want to hear both sides of the argument before I really make any decision one way or another. And usually when I do that, I find that both sides of the argument kind of have their own point, and it really just depends on how you look at it. And if it depends on how you look at it, then you're not really talking about anything that's true. You're just talking about of different points of view. And obviously you're looking at things from different sides. So it seems like then you're going to have to look at things from many, many different angles if you're going to get even part of a picture of the entire thing. You get different puzzle pieces and you put them together. But if you have a single puzzle piece and you think that that puzzle piece represents the entire puzzle, that's a mistake that I think happens a lot in music. You don't see it happening in science, you don't see it happening in literature, but I think that it's increasingly happening in music more and more, in academic music, right next to people, you know, like people will musicians will be doing these things, and then in the room next door, there's a philosophy and a sociology and a literature and a scientist who would never, ever let these things slip by. And musicians are letting them slip by, and they're letting them slip by a lot. And musicians, this is not something that is a strong point for musicians, and I think that we really, really need to consider that. So that's my lecture here on tradition, Descartes, and general semantics. I'm curious to kind of hear what you think. You know, I have a bias towards general semantics that I think other people, a lot of other people disagree with that. I'd be curious to hear what your ideas are. I think that this isn't over. I hope that this discussion is just begun. So I'm interested to hear what anyone thinks. Thank you.